This is Gil Manser letting you know that because of last night's presidential debate, this is a special Thursday night broadcast of Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media, KRCB-FM Windsor, Santa Rosa. In a Tables Are Turned twist because of the October 11th launch party for my novel, The Marvelous Journals of Miss Virginia Pettingill, I will take the writer's chair for questions from guest host Patricia V. Davis, the best-selling author, editor-in-chief of Harlot Sauce, E-Magazine, president of Harper Davis Publishing, and founding director of the Women's Power Strategy Conference. Patricia, thanks for being here. I'm ready, willing, and able to respond to your first question.
So, first of all, Miss Virginia is a novel that you've written based on stories told to you by your mother. And my first question would be, what made you decide to make it fiction rather than a family biography?
Well, you've opened an interesting question there. It started out when my mom was still alive. I wrote a short story, the part which we called The Admiral, which is the part where the beach gets fouled because of the naval ships that are in the harbor.
Yeah.
And the opportunity was that I wrote it, and I wrote it in this, you know, we're going down to the beach as a family, and the beach is all, and that reminds Grandma about what happened when she was a little girl, so she tells her story. And that's 17 years ago now. So I then wrote several other short stories. The next one was Best Friends. And I was in a writer's group with the Redwood Writers critique group, and we wrote something every month. And just before the meeting, usually the morning before the afternoon meeting, I would sit down for a couple hours and write what turned out to be chapters.
Brilliant.
And they were written as a memoir, because the other people in the group were writing memoirs. So that was kind of the feel of what we were doing, talking about parents and growing up in a certain kind of thing. And they were writing it as first person that they remembered, or third person, someone else, but it was basically their life. And I was writing this as first person as a memoir. Well, the difficulty with doing that when you put it in a book is that life is not literary. And so the sequence of events don't read well, because the climax doesn't occur where it's supposed to in a novel. It's somewhere else. And the other thing is that I was dealing with real people and real events and real places. And you always have in the back of your mind what kind of reaction is going to be from the people in Gloucester, Massachusetts, many of whom relatives, these were their ancestors.
Right, exactly.
So
sure.
I made a decision at that time that all of what I call the bad characters, or the bullies and the ones you don't like, are composites. And they're not the real names. And the ones that she talked about all the time growing up, the Eddie Spittles and the Tibby Bloombergs, I kept their real names because they're nice people and you should get to know them. And one of the other things is that I have real people who she meets. And where I could document, the meeting or the activity that went on, I used that person's real name. This was Roger Babson, who was what's called the Dogtown Millionaire, for instance, and who actually founded the bank in town and did Babson College, which is, now one of the best places to go to get a business degree. And she knew him and actually worked for him, and I knew that. And then so we use his name, for instance, but several of the other names, the people who she only had a passing acquaintance with, like the admiral and the man who used to be in, the veteran from World War I and things like that. I changed the names slightly because I put words in their mouth, shall we say. I made conversations, which may or, they're true to the idea, but probably never really occurred in that particular way. And about 5 years ago, I sat down because you put it aside. You write things and then you put them in the drawer or on the old computer, literally on the old computer. So you go to the old computer files and you pull them up and you put them all in a chronological sequence, which I did about 5 years ago. And they were fine as little short vignettes, but it didn't flow.
Gotcha.
So I then sat down and I said, well, okay, how am I going to do this? I'll make this a memoir. And then I changed things around and just said, well, they're all occurring, but not necessarily in this order. That didn't work. Because, again, I was too tied to reality.
Right.
And I went to a workshop where somebody said it was called creative nonfiction. And that's kind of the, you know, the big books that are out there, like the, you know, the one about the White City, you know, about the Chicago World's Fair. It reads based on actual events, but there's a lot of playing with things and adding characters who, you know, probably did not exist, et cetera, and they're interacting with real life people.
But this time the author is owning up to that right up front.
That's
as opposed
right.
to people discovering it later on
that's
that it's
right.
not a memoir. Gotcha.
That's, yeah. Yeah, well, we had that too because yeah. remember that happened when Oprah's famous pick of a book turned out to be not quite accurate when you know, people looked at it. So I was aware of that as well, and I decided maybe 3.5 years ago I'll write it as a novel. Well, what that did is it freed me up tremendously. In fact, in the end of the book, I write about how memory is sometimes faulty, or you elaborate the events in your mind. Because my mother told many of these stories over and over and over and over again to different audiences. And mm-hmm. I noticed, in fact, when she would tell them to her kids, she would, you know, tell it one way. When she'd tell them to a stranger she met at Lion's Restaurant, it would be slightly different.
Or like Virginia says in the book, that pile of boots just gets higher and
right.
higher.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that pile of boots did get higher and higher, yes.
There you go.
Oh, those are the boots that my grandfather went and discovered when he went to volunteer for the World War I effort. And,
yeah, that's one of the questions I had on this list, but you actually answered one in just that little explanation about Emmeline Pankhurst as opposed to Emmeline Parkhurst.
Right.
I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, I changed some events. So she is a character who obviously is identifiable, but I changed her name.
Gotcha.
Intentionally.
Okay. Well,
and I did that
go.
With the Admiral's name and several other real-life characters in the book. The original version of this, as you remember because you saw it, had 85 footnotes.
Right.
So where real people were in mentioned, like Maria Montessori, mm-hmm. who really did interact with, mm-hmm. with my grandmother, and she was the one who was picked because she was the littlest one and the cute one to present the roses to her when this famous educator from Italy came and founded one of the Montessori schools in Gloucester, Massachusetts. I think it was the second in the country. First one in Boston, as I understand. So she remembered vividly how this woman smelled. She smelled like mothballs.
Oh, my.
Yes, and lavender.
Oh, gosh. And she would tell
and
you
she
that.
She would tell us that. That was always part of the story, is this very large woman with lots of skirts that rustled because her dress was made of silk, and she smelled of lavender and mothballs.
Well, I hope that we're going to find those footnotes, or those footnotes are going to find their way to your fabulous website. Because the first thing that I did after I finished this book, which is delightful, by the way.
Thank you.
I went and I looked at all of Virginia's photos, and I did remember those footnotes. And I thought, gee, I'd like to see them, you know,
yes,
because
yes.
now they're not at the bottom of the page and kind of, I guess, what you would call mucking up the story, because the story itself just carries itself. You had a great combination, I thought, of just enough fact mm-hmm. and just enough detail and attention to history as you did concentrating on the main character's life and her adventures.
Mm-hmm.
And I know everyone who's reading this is really going to want to know how you, a male in his 60s, managed to capture on paper the voice of an 11-year-old girl from back in the 1920s.
So. Well, I could claim it was Jonathan Livingston Seagull-ish, and their voice just appeared in my head. And in a sense, that's right, because I heard my mother telling the story. And when she told the stories about being young, she would often adopt a more Gloucester-sounding voice.
Really?
You know, she sounded like West Coast most of her, you know, the time I knew her. But she would sound like she came from Gloucester. And just and that's sort of what I heard when I was writing. The other thing is that, as you know, I've written over 64 nonfiction books, and most of those are books for hire, often with another, you know, writer, another author. So I have learned to adopt a style which ties into how that other person writes.
Yeah, so, but I think this is exceptional.
Well,
I have to say, in terms of, I mean, it's the book. If I were going to be pitching it, I would be saying to people that it's Anne of Green Gables mm-hmm. meets Gloucester. That's mm-hmm. what I would be saying. And, you know, her voice is just lovely. She's lovely. And she's so interesting. And I know part of that is because it's all been set down by a loving son. But what I would ask you is you've set up each of the chapters. Well,
maybe it's time to set up the book because we really haven't explained it to our listeners yet. Essentially, okay. It starts out with – can I read that?
Yeah.
Yeah. It starts out with an excerpt from a class essay from a seventh grader in 1921. And she is writing this for her, you know, as an autobiographical assignment. And it reads – and this actually occurred – this appeared in an anthology that Redwood Writers did a few years ago and was their beginning entry into that. Celery. The squares on the walls were the color of celery, not the bright green outside part with the strings running all the way down, but the smooth white green of the inside. And the room was bright with light, and I was cold for the first time in my life. That's from a class essay, Tuesday, September 13th, 1921. And then it goes on. When Miss Clough asked everyone to begin their seventh grade autobiography assignment with the earliest thing they could remember, I didn't think it was strange that I remembered being born. After all, it's probably the most important thing that ever happens to a human being. But when I read the words aloud, my teacher suddenly stood up and pointedly stared at me. Virginia, she said, why don't you give that to me? Then she took my notebook and left the room. I noticed that her face had the same worried expression Smokey gets when it's raining outside, and she meows to get us to open door after door, trying to find some way outside where water isn't falling from the sky. I ended up in Mr. Ireland's office, where the principal told me, people don't remember being born, and then he pointedly glanced at Miss Clough. Oh, no, my teacher nodded in agreement. Babies don't remember things at all. Their minds are much too small. I could have tried to argue, of course, but by the time you are 11 years old, you better know when to keep quiet. And that's the setup. Basically, she and her best friend who lives across the street, Tibby Bloomberg, decide that these autobiography things they're writing for class, they have to be too constrained. They can't say the things they really think. So they will write a private journal for, you know, which each other can read, but only they can read, except that later in the book they wonder if after they die they will become famous and, you know, posthumously.
And that actually was going to be my question, because what I noticed is that Ginny and Tibby both, they have their essays that they hand in with their class assignment.
At the first start of the chapter.
And then they have their secret journal that they write. And only each other sees it.
There's a super secret journal for a couple entries.
I was just going to say that there's a super secret one which goes only to Tibby. Tibby lets the reader see it, but
to Virginia.
Only to Virginia. So
she won't let Tibby read it. She, in fact, writes another one that same month. That's the one about the boots, in fact.
Right, exactly.
So that Tibby doesn't get suspicious that one hasn't been done. But
there you
it's
go.
About a very very deep, dark family secret.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think actually there was another one. She writes a couple of them. One of them was about the Boston marriages.
She wrote – that was a letter that didn't get sent.
Oh,
that was written at camp.
Okay.
In summer camp, we stopped doing the class essays and we just do the private journal entries because she's not writing it, you know, for an assignment anymore. And she does several of these as letters to Tibby because she's up in the Tall Trees camp, which I changed the name of. That wasn't the real name of the place because even though it's set in a specific geographical location and the people were all the chain – you know, I changed the names of the counselors and whoever ran the camp, just to avoid any issues.
And are any of these essays or letters Virginia's actual words?
Some of the words are. Some of the sentences are.
Are they from Tyrese or something?
They're
like
from especially from the Tall Pine. Let me see. I did it. The Tall Trees camp.
Uh oh.
She wrote a diary when she was there, which I have, and she has copious notes about this stuff. In fact, one of the assignments they had was where we will be in 5 years, like, or 10 years. And so she wrote these with, you know, filled with all the people in the camp's names about they were going to be a movie star and this one's going to be a surgeon and this one's going to be a mother and take care of her and teach her children to dance and all this kind of stuff.
And she was 11 years old at
this
time.
12 then. She was 12. Because she turned 12 in that summer.
Because I noticed that from the camp, there was actually the camp schedule.
That's right.
And
that's,
I thought,
that's out of
okay,
the real
camp that's
schedule.
Got to be real. Because, yeah. Boy, what a schedule that was, 6 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I have a – this is the nice thing is that when you do this kind of research, all the stuff's there for you. Because I have all the – fortunately, the scrapbooks and lots of the letters. And in the scrapbook was the – camp brochure, and that listed what you did during the day, what you had to bring and put in your trunk, all those kind of things. So I just stole that.
That is fabulous, and I am particularly interested, and I hope you have this somewhere, the engraved certificate that your grandmother
received. I should put it on the website.
I hope you do.
With the that's a fascinating part of the book.
Yeah. I was going to ask you if you would mind reading that part. That's
what page is that?
Well, it would be on one page one. It's about the flu, actually,
right. And
then
is the super secret part.
That's right. So that would be on page 120 in here.
Uh huh. So this starts out. I don't know why I'm in such a thoughtful mood. Perhaps it is because of the discussion I had with Goon Toy, who is a real person.
Is that his real name, or you changed
that? Well, no, he had another last name, but that's what they called him.
Okay.
When I picked up our laundry, I noticed that the big white painted steel chicken that had been on the counter was gone, and a black porcelain dog was there instead. It has changed because of the Chinese New Year, Goon Toy explained. 4 weeks ago, the year of the rooster ended and the year of the dog began. This is a year for people to think carefully about what is most important to them and to thank their ancestors for their great gifts. And then she says, thank you, my ancestors, for your great gifts. As soon as I finish this, I'm going to seal it in a super secret envelope because I'm not even sure I can let Tibby read these words. It's not, as you might think, about my old parents still having sex or my being able to see the future. Instead, it is a secret that my family and I have kept hidden for 3 years. The fact that we are just one of countless numbers of families with similar secrets should make keeping things private a lot easier. But I still can't help thinking about what happened and what might have been. And essentially in this chapter, we hear the story about how her mother was the first one. This is 1918. And the flu epidemic is about to strike. It starts somewhere in a military camp in the middle of the country and then spreads quickly east and west. And it appears in Boston just around this same time of year. And it's August. And what happened is that there was a bond drive. And my grandmother, Jane McMillan Pettingill, was responsible for what was called the Fifth Ward of Gloucester. And she managed to collect $1 million in bonds, which is a heck of a lot of money. In fact, more than anyone else on the entire coast did. So she was invited down to get a presentation from the Boston, what is it called? Federal Reserve Bank, which I thought was interesting because I had never thought of, war bonds going, how they were taken care of. And so there was a big parade, and she got this certificate. And the certificate was written in such a way that it said, we want to thank you, these men who did such a wonderful help for their country. Well, she was the only woman on the stage. So they'd taken the engraved certificate and somebody wrote out men, crossed out men, and wrote woman in there instead. And I still have this certificate, in fact. But what happened is that the men who were parading in front of the reviewing stand were ill.
Oh, dear.
And because they were in large, clusters of people together, lots of people got sick. In fact, later on, as you read in the book, the people were going over in the transport ships from the East Coast, died by, hundreds and thousands on the crossover to Europe, never made it there, and were buried as soon as they arrived or at sea along the way. So anyway, my grandmother was the first person to get influenza in the city of Gloucester. And she came home. She got sick that afternoon. My grandfather, who was a foot doctor, looked at the symptoms and said, oh, my dear, sent Virginia to be picked up at school and go home and stay with her aunts. And then she said, basically, they did a self-quarantine in the house. They closed the house down. And the maid Emily stayed and helped to nurse. And the cook was sent up to back home to Nova Scotia to get away and be safe, quote unquote. And It just devastated everywhere. This is part of the history of the United States that people don't talk about.
Right.
Because so many people were affected. In Gloucester, about 20% of the population died.
Holy cow.
In other parts of the country, as much as 45% of a town would be gone in less than 2 weeks.
Wow.
And the ones who died were the young and vital ones. You know, especially men. They died more than women. But they were people in their 20s to their 40s. They were not, you know, usually it's the very young and the elderly who get the flu. Not this time. Because it was a pneumatic flu, and you would die from internal bleeding, and then your lungs would fill up with blood and you couldn't breathe.
That's
a horrible way to die.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And very fast. But you'd be gone in 3 days.
But your grandmother survived.
They did. What they did is the fever is often what killed them. So my grandfather put her in the bathtub and dropped ice around her, gave her alcohol sponge baths and enemas to lower her temperatures, because that was, you know, the sort of the homeopathic way you did that. And it worked. And she made it through and then, you know, recovered completely. But nobody in the town knew, theoretically, that this had happened. And her brother was a druggist in town. And what he did is he managed to order, you know, bags and bags of ice for his drugstore, because he said his refrigerator didn't work. And it turned out that the ice company was just a couple doors down the street. So they would bring it over, and then he would bring it up to the house and leave it on the front porch. And they just went through lots and lots of consomme and tea and, you know, liquids that she was putting through her body and the cold ice to keep her temperature down.
And was this something that your mother really did write in a super secret diary, or this was just a story that she told you?
It was a super secret story. I only heard it once.
You gotcha.
I don't remember what prompted it, but it was not something she talked about. The other thing she didn't talk about, we mentioned this about looking into the future. She did not talk about that.
Yeah, that was one of the other super secret things.
Right. Well, Tibby knew about that, but she didn't tell her. Tibby just kind of inferred because of things.
Exactly.
That occurred.
So that leads me to that question. Did she really have the gift of prophecy?
In fact, when they were first married, my father was an insurance salesman for Metropolitan Life.
Uh-huh.
And one of the first policies he sold was to the first man who died while building the Bay Bridge.
Oh, my.
And my mother looked at him and she said, well, anytime you're ready to sell a policy, let me go with you the next time. And he said, well, why? And she says, because I'll be able to help. I'll give you, you know, advice. And that's what she would do. She would be able to tell if a person was going to die within the next 2 or 3 weeks. And she'd tell my dad, no, don't do the policy. Or if the wife was going to have a baby, which was a good thing to know, or was already pregnant, because then there you could sell a larger life insurance policy because the father would feel that he had a responsibility to the next generation.
So she was a shill, shill.
Later on, we owned a small apartment house in Millbury, 6 units, and she would also go to the interview for the tenants, the would-be tenants. Because she would be able to tell, for instance, they were only studios, so a couple people's fine, but, you know, a baby would make a lot difficult to have enough space. So she would be able to tell if the people were pregnant, and she'd say, well, maybe you need a one-bedroom instead of a studio so you can look somewhere else.
See, I think that would be an interesting part of the book for you to read, where she talks about what she's able to see.
Yeah.
And it's a little, you know, it's kind of hard.
It's hard, and actually you get more of an idea of what can be seen from her aunt, Susie Pettengill,
right,
who doesn't talk about
it.
Also has it. It's something that's gone on in the women in the family for hundreds and hundreds of years.
And you believe you've actually seen evidence of this? That's fascinating.
Well, the fascinating thing is my sister read the book, and she only remembers hearing about this from my mother one time. And I thought that was amazing. And I asked her, well, do you, you know, have this gift at all? She says, no, not really.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, but she thinks maybe her daughter might.
Well, now, what exactly is it she can see if someone's...
It's basically you look at someone's face. Now, they call something the mask of pregnancy. You may have heard that. And sometimes that's a clue. Well, with this, it was the mask of death. She would see, in fact, that's described one of the first times, a skeleton face. And she knew that person was, you know, after she learned about it over the years. This started when she was about five. She learned to be able to tell if people were going to get married or fall in love, if they were having children, and if they were going to die soon.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I know she predicts that for actually one of my favorite characters in the book, mm-hmm. Eddie
yeah.
Spittle.
Yeah.
And I wonder, because you said that he was a real person.
Yes.
And so you kept his name the same.
That's right.
So did that really happen?
All I can tell
you
is that he was in the eighth grade graduation uh-huh. class list,
mm-hmm.
but he was not in the high school graduation class list.
Oh, I see.
So I don't know what happened to him because I never asked.
That's so interesting.
That's interesting because this part, I didn't put this part in the book until almost about, you know, three versions ago, which we've edited it several times, as you know, in the last mm-hmm. year. And what that did is it allowed me to have a story arc. As you've mentioned, we have Eddie sort of at the end, and we have these other things, you know, people she sees, mm-hmm. just someone who comes to her father's doctor's office, who she walks in and, you know, she says, "Oh, I hope you and the baby are doing fine." And this woman is flustered because how could this little 11-year-old know that I'm, you know, going to have a baby kind of thing, right? And, well, she does. And Tibby's sitting there just watching all this, and she knows what's going on. She knows what her friend can do. So, in fact, when one of their classmates gets injured on the school ground and is in a coma, Tibby is really upset about this for a variety of reasons. One, she thinks she might have caused it because she was, you know, saying things just to the girl just before it happened. And the other thing is she thinks the girl may die. So she goes to Virginia and gets a reassurance. Oh, no, she's okay. She'll
survive.
Here. That's
yeah.
right.
Now,
and that
you...
was true with her mother, too. She knew she didn't. Everybody else was worried about the flu, and Virginia wasn't. She says, well, she's going to be here. I haven't seen anything that tells me otherwise. So,
she also, though, does learn that it's not foolproof. This
yeah. No, it's not. And that's yeah. one of the, you know, that was kind of the fun part I had this
uh-huh.
with this was the what will be, and then Tibby says, well, what will be may not necessarily be. So there is the potential of being able to alter these predictions, which I think is a fascinating, you know, it's
sure.
almost science fiction.
Well, yeah, I suppose. But yeah. maybe that's the reason why people have this gift in the first place, because hopefully they can change some of it. Otherwise, it's more of a burden than a gift,
I think
really.
Many people find it to be a burden.
I would think
because imagine
so, yeah.
if you met someone who was, you know, young and vivacious. Well, the flu epidemic
yeah.
time. You meet them on Monday and they're dead by Wednesday, and
right.
you know it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. That would be awful.
Yeah.
That really would.
Yeah.
I think Tibby is almost as fascinating as Ginny, I think. Did you ever get to meet your mother's
oh,
best
yes.
friend?
Oh, yes. I met her several times. She came out to San Francisco, and I went back to – she lived in another part of Massachusetts with her husband, who was a teacher, and visited there. And the other interesting thing is, you know, we talk about her – well, let's talk about Tibby. Tibby is a kind of a meek and timid character at the beginning of the book. And there are a couple of events, one of them involving Tommy Sweeney's underpants. Which I won't get into much more than that.
It's pretty
which
funny.
Changes her attitudes towards herself, her confidence level. And then this summer, something happens over the summer to her. She comes back quite different than when she left. She's she has a boyfriend, or at least somebody, a kissing cousin.
Mm-hmm.
She's very sure of herself. She's able to take command. In fact, when they're going through Dogtown Common, and an accident occurs, she's able to, you know, handle it with aplomb, which she would not have been able to do, you know, just a few
exactly.
months earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted there to be a real dramatic change. The change with Virginia is much more subtle. She gets older. She starts thinking about things. There's a time when she's walking through Dogtown with her maid, Emily, who's been with her since she was 6 months old. So she's known her entire life. She lives in the room next door in the house. And she's never really thought about the fact that this young woman who came over to this country at 14 to do this job might have an entirely different life than taking care of this spoiled single child.
They were very wealthy. It's obvious.
They were not very wealthy. That's the interesting thing.
Okay.
They were. He had a consistent income
mm-hmm.
and invested it, listening to Roger Babson. But they were what is – you know, there's this debate about what is middle class.
There you go.
As a foot doctor, a chiropodist, or a podiatrist, both of which are licensed in the state of Massachusetts, he made a very – this was before insurance paying for this. So people were paying for it themselves, and it was consistent. But he also – because this was prohibition, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, he did prescriptions for medicinal alcohol. So that, I think, was the big moneymaker, because you would take the prescription down to his brother-in-law's, you know, pharmacy, and you'd get the bottled in bond, because the United States government took over the distilleries and then sold the bottled liquor, you know, with a prescription label on it.
So let's see. We have a seer who's able to tell her husband when or he should or shouldn't sell insurance.
That's
and then
right.
we've got
Well,
the,
that's not in the book. That's afterwards.
A totally different story here.
Everything in this book is point of, you know, first yes. person and only from what she sees.
Right.
So
exactly.
That's what the footnotes did is
right.
I was able to put, you know,
sure.
more historical bent on
which is what I love about it, which is what I love about this book.
You are listening to a special Thursday night broadcast of Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media KRCB-FM, Windsor, Santa Rosa. Tonight, the tables are turned due to the release of my novel, The Marvelous Journals of Miss Virginia Pettingill. I'm answering questions from our guest host, Patricia V. Davis, the best-selling author and editor-in-chief of Harlot Sauce e-magazine. So stay tuned to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media, KRCB-FM, Windsor, Santa Rosa.
If I had written this book, I think that if someone were to ask me where it would be placed, I could see it in mm-hmm. a classroom. Mm-hmm. I could see this as something that a middle school girl, for start, apart from all the adults who read young adult fiction because
right.
they just love it, you know. But apart from that, I could see a middle school girl reading this because she's quite fascinating. I mean, she does some really amazing things. I've written some of them here. She meets a genuine Native American
right.
Indian
Two
from whom
them.
She buys a very unusual basket.
We still
basket.
Have the basket. I have it at my house.
I was going to ask you about that.
Well, it's guaranteed for 100 years.
There you go.
Right.
She convinces an admiral that he needs to change his dumping practices
That's
because
right.
his naval ship is polluting his favorite beach. She beats up a bully
yes,
who is
does.
At least twice her size.
Right.
And I'd really love to know if that actually happened.
That actually happened.
Fabulous.
She was picked up by the police. She
I was going to say because
they took her to the hospital, not jail.
Well, but, yeah. this is going to lead to another question in a moment. But then she also her dad teaches her how to smoke cigars.
Yeah, on her eighth birthday,
which is super cool.
Well, it killed her.
Emphysema. Oh, she had.
Yeah.
That. I was wondering about that because
well, she smoked.
She was smoking
her entire
as
life.
Well.
Yeah. Didn't matter if it had filters on it. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was smoking. That's
that was
right.
a big bonding opportunity at summer camp, too, with one of the
with
girls.
With Gully.
She met. That's
was
right.
Actually, yeah. I wondered why you put that in there. And so actually, this all does lead to my question. Because
well, I'll tell you why I put that in there. See, the thing is writing
okay.
a novel, you have choices.
Okay.
You don't have to have the full character of what happened. But it would be unrealistic for me to write a book about a – empowered young woman,
right,
even if she's only
was.
11 or 12,
mm-hmm.
who didn't smoke at that time.
There you
that
go.
That was a way for them to say, well, you know, remember the Virginia Slims ads?
That's it. Exactly.
I can do it. The fashionable women in the magazines are all doing it. They're playing tennis, leaning on a car and smoking a cigarette.
Right, exactly.
Right.
All right. So, but then this is what leads me to, you know, here you have this book and you want a middle school girl, let's say, to pick it up and read it and be inspired by it and so
mm-hmm.
forth. And it's perfect for a classroom,
mm-hmm.
except.
Uh-huh. Which one?
Well, there are a couple of things in here. Okay. First of all. You do talk about the cigarettes,
yes.
and that's kind of open-ended. It,
well,
you know, there's
yeah,
no,
but there's an opportunity to talk about how styles, medical knowledge, et cetera, have changed
have
over the
changed.
Time.
Okay. Then there's – it's and you kind of change it in the second chapter with the teacher because it's almost as though you are supporting the violence when she beats up the bully. I mean, she really beats him up, and he's seriously hurt and stuff. And it's only in the chapter after that the teacher tries to give them another way of handling this bully.
Yeah, with her
right.
her
and
aphorisms,
then,
right?
And then the other thing is sex is very, very, it's addressed. It's addressed in a big way here when Tibby gets her period and she's all covered in, at school by mistake. She has an accident.
That's right.
It happens. Yeah. I was teaching that grade and it happens all the time. Yeah. So,
well, that's the point.
Okay.
Let me go back.
Yeah. One more question, though, on this.
Okay.
And then the last thing that you bring up. Is the lesbian couple, what you call a Boston marriage.
That was what they were called.
So how do you think some of your readers might react to
this? I assume there's going to be a reaction. I haven't had a single one yet.
Okay.
That's really – those are three of the issues that I thought might be get somebody riled up, you know, enough to write letters and that kind of stuff. The response has only been extremely favorable. It's mostly been older, you know, above 30-year-old women. And they all remember being that age. Now, we have to recall that the median age for people dying for women then was the late 50s. So girls and boys grew up more quickly. The boys at eighth grade were expected to go out and get a job, most of them. Going to high school was a luxury, even in, you know, Gloucester, well, especially in Gloucester, because they'd go and work on the fishing boats or something at the, you know, the fish plant and bring money in. And it's kind of like a farm community in that way, where your expectation for book learning was not very high. Girls were getting married at certainly by 16, many younger, and certainly getting pregnant younger. And there's a couple of references to an eighth grader girl who gets pregnant, for instance. So there's the background for this is something you probably may not know about me. But I worked for the YWCA of Los Angeles for 9 years as their program consultant.
For who?
The YWCA of Los Angeles.
The YWCA,
And I'm one of the few men who has been given an honorary membership to that organization. And one of the things that I did was develop an educational sex education program for teens called Choices or Chances, which was adopted for use nationally by the National Board of the YWCA in New York and was used in Canada as well. And the criteria then was if it occurred to at least 3% of young women or boys, whatever these events were, they would be part of this game. And it was set up as a board game where you pick cards and, you know, took a choice or a chance card. And the same thing held true here is that the realization was is these events, one of the things I wanted to show, even though it's 90 years have passed, some of the same issues are still unresolved.
Absolutely.
And some of the same learning processes are going on with our junior high kids right now. We know, for instance, the age of menarche is going lower and lower and lower.
Exactly.
So this may be an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old who's having this first period.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they know it's coming for a variety of reasons. You know, the sex education classes aren't giving till maybe 6th grade. That may be too late for some girls.
Yeah, 5th, 6th grade, exactly.
Yeah.
So you think that
– So I kind of have a soapbox with this in a sense.
Can you see this in a classroom as a reader for a classroom? Or
I can see this in the classroom if the – well, it's no different than the Judy Blume books.
No,
that's a good comparison.
Okay.
Because the same kinds of things happen. There are bullies.
Mm-hmm.
There are activities with sex. There are activities with using drugs, which there, I guess cigarettes you could consider, and alcohol. I mean – there's a sub-economy in Gloucester at this time. What's happened historically is the big moneymaker, the Gorton's Pew Fishery, which is Gorton's of Gloucester. Now it's been bought by a Japanese conglomerate, but it's the same group, had been riding high, you know, $2 million in sales a year because they were selling most of their dried fish, salted cod, to the U.S. government for, you know, the troops. Well, the war ended. That contract stopped.
There you go.
And the economy in the town, they were close to bankruptcy in this year, 1921. They filed the preliminary court records to go into bankruptcy.
Wow.
And if they had, the city would have died because everything was tied in. The glue factory got their, you know, parts of the fish that they – this is LePage's glue – that they made into, you know, their mucilage, which sold all over the country. The fish that was used for the Bird's Eye frozen foods came from that factory. If that hadn't been there, Bird's Eye would probably set up somewhere else. So it was an interesting transitional year. So in response for how the book could be used in schools, you'd have to talk about it. I would hope you'd talk about it. It's not a book you assign and then say, what did you think? And they write down, I loved it kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's more of a book to learn
explore,
from.
Exactly.
Yeah, delve into.
The history.
And think about the history of what mm-hmm. was then and compare it to what is now. The fact that the women just got the vote.
There you go. And that much hasn't changed,
that's
really.
Right. And mm-hmm. that's still, you know, dependent mm-hmm. on somebody's, what's happened in Congress or the legislature. You
yeah,
know,
no
things
kidding.
Can change.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So now I have
birth
to ask.
Birth control was another
yeah.
issue here because
yeah.
that's very subtle in this
Yeah,
book.
There was a mention of that as well.
Yeah.
So I mean,
but
on so many levels.
My grandmother was an activist with that. She was in the, before it became Planned Parenthood, it was called something else, and it was Margaret Sanger. And she actually got arrested in New York at a demonstration. And her husband came up and got her out of the jail before she got booked.
Your grandmother.
My grandmother.
She was an amazing person, too.
Yeah.
Well,
but very ladylike. With
yes.
It. That's the strange part of it.
That was
she was
true.
Very much an activist, but she always dressed to the nines and had a certain way with her, as I recall.
I can't tell you what a gift this book is for women, and that you wrote it, and you wrote it about your mother. It's very endearing. Your mother died of emphysema. How old was she when
89.
She did? Oh, she was 89.
Yeah, not a young person.
No, wow.
But my dad keeps, who's now 104, will be in October.
And what does he have to say about this?
He says that, damn it, she didn't listen to me. He says, the only thing I really regret is that she did not stop smoking. He couldn't get her to stop. And he tried over and over again. You know, they did the classes, and I don't think they had patches, but they had, you know, gum that you chewed and stuff like that.
Well, yeah. When you start at 8 years old, it's probably a pretty hard to – you're talking
exactly.
about over 80 years of – but what does he say about this book? I'm just dying to know.
He hasn't actually – he doesn't read that well.
Mm-hmm.
And he's tried to. He's got a magnifying glass he's reading with. My sister's going to be visiting him for the book launch, which is coming up on October 11th. And so she's coming up for that, and then she's going to go down and read the book to him, which should be interesting. So he knows some of it because some of the original versions, you know, he read. That was years ago now. But they've changed a lot. The dynamic of this book is significantly different. And part of that is because of the editor from Harper Davis, who took a book which had been worked on for a dozen years and said, well, this is good, but... And that's why the second sight part of this is included. It was because of Nigel's comments. And it's made the book much better.
Oh, I love the part of the book where she talks about the second sight and everything that she's able to see.
And it lets you get to meet a really, really strange and eccentric character, Miss Susie Pettengill.
Absolutely.
Who really did get letters of praise from three presidents about raising the flag every morning and singing all three verses of the Star Spangled Banner at the top of her lungs. But, of course, she was tone deaf and everybody would grimace when she'd sang. So we met a person who was in the Rockport Baptist Church choir with her, and they were always passing petitions around to say, how do we get this old lady out of here because she's making us sound awful.
And they said, too late.
Too late. She's a fixture. Yeah.
She is.
Yeah.
And a delightful one at that in some ways. You
but
talk.
Let me go one more step.
Sure.
One of the things, there's a line in here where Virginia asks her, how do you keep all this information in check? How do you resolve it? And she says, I swim. And every morning she goes out, literally sometimes breaking the ice in the harbor, and swims for half hour or more in the, you know, whatever time of year. And she did that for most of her life till about a year before she died.
In order to
just take care of the
process
demons.
The
right.
demons from the second sight.
That's right.
That's,
it wasn't just, it was not for exercise. It was for exorcism.
That's really amazing. They're fascinating people. The challenges of writing a novel versus all the nonfiction books that you've written, and especially one that's based on family stories.
Mm-hmm.
What were the hardships? What were some of the joys?
Well, there's a difficulty in writing family stories. I've written a second book, which is based on my father's stories. It's set in Los Angeles called Hollywood Bo. And that's because that's his nickname is Bo, and he lived in Hollywood or just outside. And in 1925, and he went to school with someone named Michael Morrison, who we mostly know as John Wayne. And yeah, just and he was involved in some of the movies that were made, and
wow.
He was an extra in a Charlie Chaplin film and stuff like that. Because you lived there, that's what you did. And so that's based on his stories, and it is the voice in there is entirely different than in here because it's a guy writing.
Sure.
And there's none of the, you know, writing it for the class. He's just writing a journal
mm-hmm.
to whoever. One of the things I did here, which was really helpful, was one of the editors of the anthology said, well, who is Virginia writing to? And so we explained that she's writing to this mysterious person, both she and Tippy, to this mysterious person in the mirror who looks a lot like them but is somebody who doesn't know these stories until they're told on paper. Anyway, so I was going to write a third book, which was about growing up in, you know, the suburbs of San Francisco, Millbrae, California, in the 50s. And I told my sister about that, and she went, no, you're not. Because that was too close to home.
Oh, yeah.
So by doing this, you know, a generation ago, I didn't have – there's not that many – there are my dad. That's it,
mm-hmm.
you know, who remembers this stuff. And he wasn't in Gloucester then. He was out in California then. So none of the people who were there are around. So they can't say, hey, by the way, you know, that's absolutely not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. It's a novel. And that's – that's a real challenge because, especially when you're writing about your mother, you've got to be a little bit careful. And my sister had reactions to the lesbian couple getting married. She said, that didn't really happen. I said, well, the story I heard it did. So she heard different stories from my mother. In fact, we're going to get together in a few weeks, and she's going to say, you know, don't you didn't add this one in there. And I probably haven't heard it because mother was very specific about who her audience was.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How did your parents meet? I don't think you've ever addressed
that.
Well,
that's in the third book. In the trilogy.
The one that you haven't started yet.
She ends up, you know, we met Roger Babson, and he invites her, you know, and starts, if she will put her money in the bank, he will, you know, give her a scholarship to Babson College. But she became such a proficient and really quite nice singer. She got a scholarship to Tufts University and on a music scholarship in part, and she would sing in the church and at other activities on campus as part of getting this. And when she was there, she became the social chairman of the Chi Omega House, which was a sorority. And her job was to, you know, call the other social chairmen and the men's fraternities and have them make sure that they would have somebody come for the girls who weren't going to, you know, the wallflowers. So the story that I hear is that she called the DU house one time, and my father was the social chairman there, and he answered and he says, well, what nags do you want me to send somebody over for this time? And she says, well, I didn't have a nag in mind. I was thinking of me, and perhaps you might come.
Oh.
So they began dating as seniors. Both went to signed up for graduate school, 1932. And he was going to be a doctor and she was going to be a teacher at Tufts. They got married in the university chapel in October. They took a trip across the country in a 1931 Ford, you know, with the top that would fold back, Model A. And hit California and never went back. I mean, they went back for visits, but they ended up living out here because apparently my mother said to my father, well, who on earth would want to go back to that cold, rocky place?
There you go.
But it was a big upset to her parents who, you know, the entire existence was built around Gloucester. And they would come out to visit.
And around her. She's
an
only
child.
She's
the only child.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, just as parents today who are taking their kids to, you know, music lessons and sports activities, and that becomes your life for a while.
Yeah.
And then when they go off to college and you've got this empty nest, it must have been really difficult for them.
And then, well, they were amazing people, though, as well.
They were.
I mean, we could talk about this book for hours. There's so much in it, even just about your grandparents, that, and they're not even the main characters in the story.
Well, see, but the nice thing about writing about real people is that you don't have to create them. They're there.
They're actually there.
Or at least my impressions of how they were are there.
Sure, which is the best way you want to be written about is by a loving son, a loving grandson. Or who wouldn't want that?
yeah, but remember, there's a lot of people writing books about childhoods which they resent.
Oh, yeah.
Someone.
So this is kind of delightful. It's a nice change. Yeah. Now, you're going to
let me go on that.
Sure.
That was a calculated risk. You'd mentioned earlier before we went on air, why did I decide to go with a small upstart fledgling publisher for this instead of one of the big people with more money up front? Well, there's a variety of reasons for it. And one of them is this is not a formulaic young adult book. Most of them, and you made a comparison at the beginning to, for instance, the Anne of Avonlea kind of stuff. She is an orphan who struggles against horrible things and manages to persevere. That is a very, very common motif in young adult fiction.
Whereas that's not the case.
This
with
is
Virginia.
Not the case. I wanted to show that someone who was raised in really very privileged circumstance could take those multiple classes and not think about it, go to summer camp, get high button shoes and boots or wherever when she went to the store, had a life that was full of the sense of responsibility of trying to make things better in the world that you're living in. And it doesn't matter, you know, where you came from. I think that's true of most of, you know, the people at this age. They're very optimistic. And that somehow or other gets, maybe by high school things change a little bit, you know, the realities of dealing with things. I'm going to do the book, the third book in the series is going to be starting in senior high school. And it'll be interesting to see how Virginia changes if she has. She must. She's older. Things have happened in life and history by then. And we don't know where Eddie is.
So that's one of your reasons why you think that why you chose to go with a publisher that wouldn't expect the formulas.
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
Okay.
Because it gives me freedom to do that. This is a book that, as a writer, and I've been writing since I started in graduate school because I used to write for, the other professors hated to write, so I'd write their journal articles. Writing is, you know, people talk about these blank, I can't, you know, writer's block and all that. I've never had it. I sit down in a chair and boom, I start to write. You know, I may change it and edit it and take this paragraph and move it around, which is the wonderful things of computers because it used to be typewriters.
Yeah, no kidding.
And there's a freedom to writing a novel that you don't have in a nonfiction book, which is you've basically done a proposal, you know, which is an outline of this will be A, B, C, D, this will be X, Y, Z. And you kind of have to continue with that because that's the contract you've made with
them
to do that. Mm-hmm. Things may come up along the way and you renegotiate because you find something that needs, you know, more elaboration because you just didn't know it when you did the original draft. But it still goes in essentially the same format. This one, a novel has a life of its own. And I know I was talking with a novelist, Amanda McTighe, just recently on the last show, and she was talking about how the people kind of the characters begin to speak to her, and she didn't know what they were going to do at the start of the book, and by halfway through or the end, they had done what they were going to do, and she didn't have to wonder about it at all. But they decided, she didn't. And that's sort of like how this was in writing this. It was very
freeing. It sounds like it was very freeing.
Yeah.
So now you're going to be – you said something about – I would love for your listeners to know while we have a few minutes left that you're going to be – you said there's a book launch. Is that –
The book launch is on October 11th, 7 o'clock, which is the same night, unfortunately, as the vice presidential debates.
Oh, my.
But it's going to –
Gee, that's going to be a tough choice for me.
Well, I don't know. The launch is at the new Sebastopol Center for the Arts, which is the old Sebastopol Veterans Building. It's one of the first events they're having there.
That's beautiful, too.
And it is. It's mm-hmm. a nice center, a wonderful opportunity for the center. Mm-hmm. And I'll be showing some of the, you know, photos that are in the book. I can find even a recording of Virginia singing, which I have somewhere
lovely.
In some file. And also we're going to have blueberry cake and tea because, as you know, Russian tea is a very, very important part
yes, it is.
Of Mrs. Bloomberg's social style. And the blueberry cake is the one that she takes to the Admiral when she goes to visit him on his flagship.
Yeah. Any Moxie soft drinks?
No, because that's horrible stuff. I had some when I was back in Gloucester one time. Actually, I got it in Rockport.
Uh-huh.
And we had Moxie and sarsaparilla and something. Oh, ginger beer, which
oh
is
my.
Not ginger ale. It's a different, it's much stronger ginger taste. And we decided that Moxie was an acquired taste. Harper Davis is going to be doing an event in November at Book Passage down in Corte Madera. And what was the date for that, too?
I believe it's the 10th of November.
So that's right. In the evening?
That's in the afternoon,
from
1 to 4.
Okay.
Yeah, that'll be lovely. Sojourns and Compendiums. That's going to be.
So I'll be there, and then I think I'll be reading, you know, obviously some excerpts at these events as well.
Which will be fabulous.
Right.
Well, I think you should congratulate yourself on a fabulous first novel, and I know that anyone who reads it is going to look forward to the second and the third installments for sure. And I look forward to this being something that every young woman wants to read because I think it's valuable on so many levels, historically as well as spiritually. So
it's a spiritual book.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a very... as you know, it mentions she goes to several different churches because she sings in all of them with her father and by herself. And she was raised in the Unitarian Universalist Congregational tradition in Massachusetts, which is old school universalism, where basically everyone is saved. And that's a point of view which many people don't have today. And it's decidedly different. And I think it infuses the book.
I think it does, too.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
It was totally my pleasure, really. And I will be there on October 11th at the Sebastopol
Center
for the Arts with bells on.
Well, good. And everyone, we want to invite all of my listeners to come to that event. It will be fun. I will surprise, have books for sale, and I'll even be glad to autograph them for you.
That's
and then
terrific.
You get to meet Patricia V. Davis, and who is a wonderful novelist in her own right. Thank you. You have been listening to a special Thursday night broadcast of Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media, KRCB-FM, Windsor, Santa Rosa. Tonight, the tables were turned due to the release of my novel, The Marvelous Journals of Miss Virginia Pettingill. As a result, you heard me answering questions from our guest host, Patricia V. Davis, the best-selling author, editor-in-chief of Harlot Sauce magazine. The sound engineer for tonight's broadcast is Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We want you to tune in to our next Word by Word Conversations with Writers show on Wednesday, November 7th, when our guest will be the celebrated writer T.C. Boyle, with his new novel set in Santa Barbara's Channel Islands called San Miguel. Until then, I invite you to join us at the official launch party for my new novel, The Marvelous Journals of Miss Virginia Pettingill, starting at 7 p.m. October 11th at the new Sebastopol Center for the Arts, and all KRCB listeners are invited to meet Miss Virginia Pettingill and share some of her favorite tea and blueberry cake.